All right, the 22nd chapter of the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 22, or rather, I guess Numbers 25 is where we're going to be tonight, Numbers, the 25th chapter. We were introduced last time to that very bizarre character by the name of Balaam, just a strange kind of guy that just comes, you know, literally out of nowhere. He just shows up. And he is called by King Balak, who was the king of the Moabites, and he wanted him to curse Israel. Israel has already wiped out the Amorites, and Israel is set on course to go right through the middle of Moab as they were on their way to the gateway of the Promised Land, as they were then going to be led by God on into the Promised Land to take that which was promised to Abraham many hundreds of years before. Now, you remember Balaam comes and he tries to curse the people, but everything that comes out of his mouth is a blessing. And Balak is getting irritated and he's upset. And finally he says, look, man, just shut your mouth. I'm not going to pay you anything and just get home right now. So at the end of chapter 24, they part company, terribly upset with each other. Now, if we finished reading at the end of chapter 24 and then had to figure out how does the story end, we would probably say, well, they come to the gateway of the Promised Land, march right in there and just wipe out all of their enemies. But that is not what happens. In chapter 25, it is not the enemies of Israel that's getting wiped out. It's Israel themselves. And you think, what in the world is going on? Obviously, there is something that had transpired between chapter 24 and chapter 25. Chapter 24, Israel, it's being prophesied, they're going to be blessed, they're going to wipe out all of their enemies. Chapter 25, Israel is cursed and they're getting wiped out. Well, let's read it. Beginning in verse 1, Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their God, and the people did eat and bow down to their gods. And Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, take up all of the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined to Baal Peor. Now, apparently what has happened is that some of the ladies of the Midianites and the Moabites, they're one and the same, that they come into the camp of Israel and they get some of the young Israeli men interested in their wares, shall we say. And in the process of this activity, it was understood that this is how that they were to worship their gods. So the sexual activity actually evolved into a worship service, if you will. The anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and a plague began to break out in the midst of Israel. Now, the interesting thing is that when we get to chapter 31, there we will discover that this was the brainchild of Balaam. Apparently, Balaam was on his way back home, perhaps somewhere between 300 and 600 miles away and riding on the back of a burro. He got plenty of time to think, and he was thinking, man, all of that loot down the drain, and he was going to give me honor and riches, and oh, man, it's just all wasted. How can this thing work out? And then all of a sudden, it came to him. I got it. I know what to do. And so he went back to King Balak and said, Balak, this is the counsel that I'm giving you. You see, you can't curse Israel, but Israel can curse themselves. So you send some of your young gals down there, get them worshiping your gods, and then their God will wipe them out. And that is exactly what's going on here. Now, Moses then says, look, the perpetrators of this great sin need to be held accountable and they need to be put to death. So there was no tolerance on Moses' part. Now, you know, today we celebrate diversity, and, you know, diversity is something that, you know, we're really into. Now, there are healthy aspects of diversity, but there are deadly aspects of it as well, particularly when it comes to religion. The idea, the very idea that all religions are right is absolutely bizarre to me. I mean, how can all religions be right. If you have Islam saying God has never had a son, and then you have Christianity saying, well, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten. So, well, how? What do you mean they're both right? How does that work? Islam says Jesus never died on the cross. And, of course, Christianity says, well, look, he that knew no sin became sin for us. And, of course, the differences go on and on. So the idea of us celebrating diversity, everybody's right, and, you know, never get on anybody else's nerves or whatever, that was not Moses' program. Moses' program was this is sin. And this needs to be judged sternly and strictly. So then in verse 9, and behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all of the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation and he took a javelin in his hand. And he went in after the man of Israel into the tent and he thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. And so the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. And those that died in the plague were 24,000. So apparently there was this prayer vigil going on. The faithful in Israel are gathered there at the tabernacle. They're weeping. They can't believe what the rest of their brethren are doing. And almost an in-your-face kind of a move from this guy from the tribe of Simeon, he brings this temple prostitute just right there to the door of the... I mean, here are the people praying and crying before God and seeking God. And he's bringing this whore just kind of right through there. And everybody knows what they're up to. And apparently this guy runs them through in the very act of their immorality. And so here is a picture of one guy standing up against the tidal wave of immorality that he was facing, and it made a difference. I think that sometimes we think, well, what does it matter? I mean, in the face of this tidal wave of crud that is overtaking our culture, what does my voice and what does my life really mean in the entire scheme of things? Well, here's an example of one guy that said, enough is enough, and I'm going to make a stand against this evil. And God blesses it, and God honors what this man does, and the plague is stopped. Well, the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, he has turned my wrath from away from the children of Israel, while he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consume not the children of Israel in my jealousy. Wherefore, say, behold, I will give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of the everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God, and he made an atonement for the children of Israel. So God blesses this guy. God blesses him with the promise that there's going to be peace in his life. Now, a lot of times, we don't want to stand up against negative influences in our culture and families and neighborhoods and so forth, because we're afraid, well, it's going to disrupt things, and it's going to, you know, turn my life upside down, and it's going to rob me of peace. And yet here, the example that we have with this man is just the very opposite. This man takes a stand, and God says, I am going to establish a covenant of peace with this man. This guy is going to have peace coming out of his ears because he is zealous for my great name's sake. Now, the name of the Israelite that was slain with the Midianish, say that 10 times fast, woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, the prince of the chief house among the Simeonites. And the Midianitish woman that was slain was Cosby. Don't know if Bill was her dad or not. And the daughter of Zur, and he was the head over the people. He was chief in the house of Midian. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, vex the Midianites and smite them, For they vexed you with their wiles, wherewith they have beguiled you in the matter of Peor, and in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of the prince of Midian, their sister, which was slain in the day of the plague for Peor's sake. Now, isn't it interesting the destructive nature of sin? That just 24 hours before this, here are the people of God. They're at the gateway of the promised land. No curse is effective against them. God is promising them victory over even the giants that are in the land. And yet, even though the enemy could not curse them, they could curse themselves. And now, you know, 24 hours earlier, great promise, great hope, and now 24,000 of them lie dead in the streets in the camps of Israel, all because of sin. Now, a lot of times we think, ooh, Satan, he's the big enemy. Watch out for Satan. And, you know, we're rebuking Satan often, and we're coming against Satan. And though he is a roaring lion roaming about seeking whom he may devour, what we have to come to terms with is the fact that our greatest enemy is ourself. What the enemy could not do to Israel, Israel was allowed to do to themselves. The enemy could not get at Israel, but Israel could be stupid, shoot themselves in their own foot, and destroy themselves. And the same thing is true for the believer. Look, no curse can prosper against the child of God. And yet we can go out and make poor decisions for ourselves and bring in all kinds of heartache. It wasn't Satan. It was our own stupidity that did it. And Israel is a case in point. Now, as we come to chapter 26, we now come to the second numbering. And of course, that's where the book gets its name. And we're going to look just real briefly at these numbers. We'll notice that some of these tribes actually went down. We notice the, first of all, the tribe of Reuben, that in the beginning of the 38 years wilderness journey, they had 46,500, and now they're down to 43,730. So they've lost about 6%. Now, Simeon, this is the guy that Zimri was from, or that was the tribe that Zimri was from. These guys really took it on the chin during this wilderness journey. Their numbers declined 63%. So apparently, this particular tribe was not walking near unto the Lord during the wilderness journey. And then the tribe of Gad, they were down 11%. Judah had an increase of 3%. Issachar went up by 18%. So there were some good things going on in that tribe. Zebulun went up 5%. Now Manasseh, which is interesting, as Simeon went down 63%, Manasseh actually had a 64% increase. So we can't say that these negative numbers are the result of environmental conditions. Clearly, you have human beings living in the same environmental conditions where one, their numbers are being cut well over half, and another, their numbers are increasing well over half. So it had to do with their walk with the Lord and how God was blessing their life. And then we've got, then after Manasseh, you've got Ephraim. They went down 20%. And then Benjamin, a 29% increase. The tribe of Dan, 3% increase. Asher, 29% increase. Naphtali went down 15%. Levi, you remember, is not counted because these are only the numbers of those men who are eligible to go into the battlefield. This is the number of troops that Israel was able to marshal into the battlefield. So they started out 38 years earlier with 603,550 troops, and they end up with 601,730 troops. So there was a net loss of 0.3%. So essentially, there was stagnation in the camp of Israel, that it wasn't a time of blessing, but it wasn't a time of great decrease. Now, for some tribes, that it was. Now, compare this with the years leading up to the Exodus. In other words, the years leading up to the Exodus, I mean, they were, you know, prospering like jackrabbits, for crying out loud. I mean, the king of Egypt was saying, these people, I mean, I don't know what's in their water, but we need to put an end to this right now and throw them into slavery. So here they were being thrown into slavery, and yet their population numbers were going through the roof. They were even taking some of their babies and throwing them outside. The Egyptians were killing some of the baby boys. So here they were in the clutches of the enemy, and yet they were still prospering. Now here they are in the wilderness, you know, surrounding the very presence of God, and yet there's stagnation. So it doesn't have anything to do with your environment. It does, well, you know, the people I live around, they're all crummy, and that's why my life is crummy. Or my boss is crummy, and that's why my life is crummy. No, the environmental conditions of your life do not matter. If you're drawing close to God, He can prosper you even in the most negative of situations. Well, then finally, in chapter 27, an interesting thing arises here, that there came these four daughters, were given their names at the end of verse 1, that there was Mahala, Noah, interesting, a daughter named Noah. This guy really wanted a son. And then Hogla, apparently the daughter that liked to eat a lot, and then Milcah and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and before Eliezer the priest, and before the princes of the congregation by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, and he was not of the company of them that gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but he died of his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be done away with from among the family because he had no sons? Give unto us, therefore, a possession among the brethren of our father." And Moses brought their case before the Lord. Now, normally, inheritances were handed down from father to sons. Now, don't think that somehow the culture was negative against women when it came to inheritance. It was just assumed that a daughter's inheritance would be something that she would receive when she was married. Let's say a young man came to your house, wanted to marry your daughter. You would bargain with this young man for a price, and he would give you a dowry. Now, what that was for was actually an insurance policy against whether her husband would die at an early age, or maybe he would divorce her. It was sort of a marriage and life insurance policy. It could be land, it could be furniture, it could be clothing, it could be jewels, anything of value, so that if the marriage went south or if the gentleman died, she could then go back to her father, and her father would have all of this loot waiting for her. And so that was the daughter's inheritance. Now, here's a situation where these four girls, five girls, come to Moses and they say, "Now look, our dad, though not a great guy, he wasn't a bad guy either. He did not join into the rebellion with Korah. And he was just one of the guys, like many in Israel, that was too chicken to go in and take the land that you had promised them. And now he's died and he doesn't have a son. So why is it, as we are now on the verge of going into the promised land to begin to cut up this territory and to give it to the various families, why is it that our father should be punished because, you know, he didn't have any sons, and, you know, it's not his fault that he didn't have any sons. Why should his name be left out of the promised land? It seems to us it's only fair that we should receive the inheritance that would have normally have gone to our father's sons." Well, Moses, to his credit, and I like Moses. Moses was the kind of guy, he didn't need to know everything. I mean, you know, if you went up to him and asked him something, he didn't make it up. He wasn't making it up as he went along. He said, "You know, that's an interesting thing. I don't know, but I know somebody that does. I'm going to go find out for you." And so he goes to the Lord. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad, they have spoken right. And you shall surely give unto them a possession of the inheritance among their father's brethren, you shall cause the inheritance of their father to pass unto them. And you shall speak unto the children of Israel, and say, if a man die and he has no son, that you shall cause his inheritance to be given unto his daughter. If he doesn't have a daughter, then you shall give it unto his brethren. If he doesn't have any brethren, then you shall give it to his father's brethren. If his father doesn't have any brethren, then his inheritance shall go to his next of kin. And he shall possess it, and it shall be unto the children of Israel a statute for a judgment as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, God appears to be pleased with these gals. I mean, after all, it was a thing of faith on their part, was it not? I mean, weren't they essentially saying, we believe God is going to give us this land. And so therefore, we want this land. He hasn't given it to us yet, but we know God is going to give it to us. So these women are really standing in that place of faith. And I believe that God is very pleased with their position. And he says to Moses, look, you know, don't be chauvinistic. Give the chicks the ground. And so they do. And so the Lord then said unto Moses, get thee up to the Mount of Ararat and see the land that I have given unto the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you shall be gathered unto your people as Aaron your brother was gathered. And you rebelled against my commandment in the desert of Zin and in the strife of the congregation to sanctify me at the water before their eyes, that is the water of Meribah and Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Now, the Lord is saying, I want you to go on top of the mountain and there you're going to die. He does not die until we get to Deuteronomy chapter 34, which is actually several months from this event that we're reading here. Apparently, what the Lord is telling Moses, as again, you got to keep in your mind, they are making their way closer and closer to the promised land. When they get to the promised land, there's going to be this mountain. Moses is to go on top of the mountain where he can see the land of Israel, and there is where he's going to die. That is still months away. Apparently, what the Lord is interested in is much like what he did with King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah, your time is up. I'm going to bring you home. So get your house in order. Apparently, that is what he is telling Moses here. Get your house in order. Set things in right. Your absence is going to create a huge void of leadership in Israel. We need to take care of that problem, and so prepare yourself to die. Now, notice Moses' response. Imagine if God comes to you tonight and says, hey, get things in order, you're going to die. Well, how would you react? Well, notice what Moses does. Moses spoke unto the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, which may go out before them and which may go in before them, which may lead them out and which may bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord be not as sheep that have no shepherd. This is the heart of the man. And notice how his heart is shining. I mean, there's no selfish interest here. Notice there's no whining. Oh, please don't kill me. There's none of that stuff here. He has the heart. On his heart are the people of the Lord. I mean, I really see Moses as sort of being a parent that's maybe on their deathbed. And though they don't want to leave their children and they're not too excited about leaving, yet they have concerns for those that they're leaving behind. And that's where Moses is at here. Moses is not saying, oh, you know, hey, you know, give me another shot. I think I can do better. But rather, okay, you know, that's fine. But what in the world are we going to do about the children? I mean, what are we going to do about the children of Israel? They need to be taken care of. So the heart of the man, and this is why God used this man to such a great degree, is because he wasn't into himself. He was into the welfare of others. So then the Lord spoke unto Moses and said, I want you to take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom the Spirit is, and lay your hand upon him, and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all of the congregation, and give him charge in their sight, that you shall put some of your honor upon him, that all of the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall ask counsel for him after the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his word they shall go out, and at his word shall they come in, both he and all of the children of Israel with him, even all of the congregation. And Moses did as the Lord commanded him, and he took Joshua, and he set him before Eleazar the priest and before all of the congregation. And he laid his hands upon him, and he gave him charge as the Lord had commanded him by the hand of Moses. Now, again, I think that this public display of Moses saying, okay, Joshua is now taking over the reins of control, was very important. Remember, you're talking about a million ball babies here that would, you know, rebel at just, you know, the slightest provocation. And it was very important that they have an understanding that, look, make no mistake about it, this guy is the guy, and he was really protecting them, I think, from civil war. Now, not only is there a changing of the guard here, but notice very carefully that there is also a changing of revelation being given. You see, before this, they would come to Moses and say, hey, we got a problem. Moses would say, no problem. I'll go find out from God. He would come back with the answer. That deal is now forever over with. You remember that one of the things that God brought up earlier to Miriam and Aaron in their criticism of Moses, God said, there is nobody like Moses that I speak to face to face. I'm no longer going to be speaking to your leaders in the same way that I spoke to Moses. There is now going to be some distance. There's going to be some separation between me and yourselves as you enter into the land. Now, why did the Lord do that? I don't know. But from now on, here is Joshua the leader. And rather than when he is faced with a difficult situation saying, well, I'm going to go find out from God, he is now to take these heavy situations to Eleazar the priest. And the priest is now to go before God with the Urim and the Thummim. You remember these two garments that were on the breastplate. In the Hebrew, it means lights and perfection. Perhaps one would become illuminated, or maybe one would be dark. If the answer was yes, it would be illuminated. If the answer was no, it would stay dark or whatever. And so now God is going to be leading Israel through the ministry of the priest with the Urim and Thummim, and Joshua is not just going to speak face to face with God. Now notice the three things here. I mean, here are these two men greatly used of God, and we notice three things about them. First of all, with Moses, we notice that he is interested in others. He has other people's interest upon his heart. Notice the thing about Joshua. Why was Joshua chosen? Notice that the Lord said, because the Spirit is in him. Now, he's not saying, well, because he's a real smart guy, or boy, he's got a lot of gumption. You know, I like the spirit of that kid, and you know, he's a type A personality or whatever. No, the word spirit here in the Hebrew means the power of God. The power of God is in this man's life. So here we have a picture of people who are other-centered, interested in other people, and they have the power of God in their life. And then finally, notice two times, both in verse 22 as well as in verse 23, the repetition of, as the Lord commanded, as the Lord commanded. That was sort of the theme of Moses' life. If you had to say, well, how would you describe Moses? He did what the Lord commanded, except for the occasion there at Meribah, and boy, did he pay dearly for that one. And so when we think of ourselves and we think of God desiring to use us, what are the characteristics that make us usable for the Lord? It is being other-centered, having an interest in other people, seeking that the power of God might be manifested in our life, and making sure that as we are ordering our life, it is as the Lord has spoken.